So, okay, now you perhaps be interested. Next slide, please. Oh, yeah, first one. That one of the places the angel on the left lives is in Dante's Inferno. Okay? Now, this is Botticelli's image of hell. And the dark angel lives right there. And so when Dante solicits Virgil, who's lived in the upper regions of hell, in limbo, to take him down into his unremembered pain, and we'll chart that journey tomorrow, they have to go down through all these nine levels, and there's a gate at each level, until they reach, next slide. In other words, now you're looking at the funnel from above, and there on the in the very bottom, you see the devouring figure of the dark angel. Next slide. This is from a Pisan manuscript from 1300s in Italy, and it shows you the dark angel devouring sinners in each of his three giant maws. He's like another world trinity, terrifying figure of violence and destruction. Now you can imagine my excitement when I read Dante's Inferno and I discovered his name for this creature, which is none other than capital D-I-S. You know why I was so excited, right? I mean, that's the same, that means to split in two, to attack all the links. It's the word from which we get dissociate, it's the word from which we get dis-ease, from all the dis words. Dismember, disaffection, disconnection, even disaster, which means to come apart from your star. Come apart from your star. So when I discovered that Dante's wisdom was such that he actually put the Lord of Dissociation in the bowels of hell, that convinced me that this imagery, this medieval imagery of hell, and we're going to explore it tomorrow as an enclave of defense, of the defensive structure. The wisdom of our poets is writ large in this fortuitous experience that I had of discovering this. Okay, what time is it? Oh dear, it's 9:10. Okay, we have to stop here at what time? 9:30? Okay, we'll take a few questions and then we'll come back to this tomorrow. Yes.
I wonder if you could explain a little more. This is going quite a ways back in your talk. It's so fascinating, Freud's ability of his rejection of being able to take in or understand what Jung was presenting to him. Do you have an understanding of what wasn't in Freud that just couldn't go there?
Well, I'll tell you a story about Freud that has always answered that question for me. Remember that Jung was trying to interest him in two worlds, and he considered that regression. Regression back to what? Regression back to magical thinking. So everything that Freud was identified with in terms of rationality and one world existence and science, Jung was saying, yes, but there's wisdom in these symbolic early stories that we must try to understand. And you can't just take an image and translate it into one thing. You have to take the whole symbol. You know, the old thing that we used to talk about in analytic training was, you know, if a pencil is a penis, and the Eiffel Tower is a penis, and the cigar is a penis, what on earth does it mean when you dream of a penis?
Cigar.
Right, I mean, Freud had it all reduced, and Jung was trying to open it up. But one of the stories, it's apocryphal, but a woman who I will talk to you about in the coming few days, Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer, who wrote a book called Extraordinary Knowing, was a psychoanalyst in California, and she would go to the salon parties that had been sponsored by various analysts in London for the professor, Freud, and his daughter would often be dinner guests at these salon parties in London. And so there were frequent stories about them, about the old professor, you know, how gracious he was, what an incredibly educated, beautiful, lovely man, dinner partner he was, and so forth. But then at the end of each of these parties, music would begin. And Freud unerringly excused himself and left the party when the music started. And one of these analysts asked him, decided that she was going to ask him, and she did at the next party. And he said to her, "I don't like how music makes me feel." And the woman reported, "He preferred to be much more controlled in his feelings." Now, you know how music transports us. And if we're not ready to go there, we can see why someone might excuse themselves when things got really feelingful. So that to me spoke volumes. You know, and that accords with many instances of Jung's personal moments with Freud, where he would reduce something to a simplistic formula. Yeah.
It seems tremendously limiting.
Yeah.
Extremely limiting,
right,
of him as a person.
I think so. Yes.
I just want to add something about that. I was in one incarnation of a member of a Freudian society in Washington. And Freud was really afraid. He saw the dark side of religion. And he saw the dark side of religion in Europe and the anti-Semitism,
right,
and superstition and,
yeah,
witch burnings. And so, you know, he felt that in order to kind of get out of the madness of religion, in our own culture of climate denying, we needed the sure rock of the sexual theory.
Right.
And but because of his limited viewpoint, he couldn't see that there were positive resources,
right, exactly,
there too.
Right.
And so, you know, perhaps with this two-world view, there's a way of, in a sense, acknowledging the fact that, you know, what Freud was, he was seeing part of the picture. But, you know, is in Jungian theory, if you look at a field negatively, it looks back at you negatively, too. I don't think he was able to, obviously not able to see positive resources.
I think that's right. He was not able to see the positive resources. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, truth be told, there are huge shadow sides to religious.
Of course.
But the symbolic dimension is something that we're going to try to,
yeah,
find a way to thread the needle here. Between the two extremes.
To keep to our schedule, maybe one more question.
Okay. Go ahead.
You mentioned Fairburn and Gunship, and I love them at all. But when you talk dissociation, Melanie Klein, don't you have to talk, you know, the good breast, the bad breast, and the devouring mother and the good mother, and
yeah.
I don't like her because she was too much in the death instinct, I don't really thought. But
yeah,
she.
Well, you see, Melanie Klein had the idea that the infant was filled with rage because of various factors, including deprivation and lack of control over the mother. And the infant projected this rage onto the mother, and it couldn't really make that fit because the infant also was desperately needful of the mother, so that infants split the mother into two parts, the good breast and the bad breast, and then became paranoid that it was going to be attacked by the bad breast because it had projected all its rage into the bad breast. And so Klein's idea is that the ego was forming around the goodness in the child's perception of the mother's good breast, And so the child had to evacuate the bad and keep it out of the good in order to form an ego. Now, Klein's idea is that the child with a split object like that is in the paranoid persecutory position. And Klein's idea is that as development occurs, the child starts to begin to be able to feel good and bad feelings, anger and loving feelings towards the same mother. In other words, it begins to perceive that the good and the bad breasts are parts of a whole. And that she calls the depressive position, in which the child is in conflict about its own angry and its own loving feelings. And it works out that conflict with the person. So if you've ever had the experience of getting really fully pissed off at your partner, and raging and raging and raging and feeling like everything was over, and then discovering that not only your partner survived your rage and still loved you, but that the relationship survived your rage, you'll have a very alive experience of what Melanie Klein means by the gratitude that comes with the depressive position. It's like your anger has not destroyed the object. We can get into this more tomorrow. I want to say something about the film you're going to see tomorrow. Well, I hope you're going to see. Okay, I mean, we're going to show As It Is in Heaven. I'll be here for it, for the showing. This is a... How many of you have seen the film now? Okay, not that many. Well, listen, I hope you'll come, because even though I realize it's a packed schedule and this is one of the only breaks in the day, I'm hoping that you'll all see it, because this is a beautiful film about the central thing that I want to try to hope you'll take away from this weekend, which is trauma is an injury to the capacity to feel. And the central character in this film, Daniel Darius, has had a couple of severe childhood traumas. And his capacity to feel and his capacity to love are severely injured. And the film shows how that capacity is healed in community. And because this is a healing community, I think it will speak very deeply to you in terms of how that healing happens and how what is closed in the various characters in the film gradually opens through the medium of music and the love of people in the small community. So I recommend it highly. We'll have some conversation about it tomorrow after you see it. Okay, see you tomorrow.
To the mundane or grounded, but we need to do it. I'm Marion Snipes, and I'm the coordinator of the leaders of the small interest groups. I want to make just a few comments about the conference in relation to the small interest groups, because the small interest groups, from the very beginning, were a pair. The conference was a two-pronged activity from the beginning. And it was the plenary speaker, and then these small interest groups. And the small interest groups kind of serve to integrate what we've heard in the plenary talks, and they serve to allow us to go deeper and perhaps shake up the unconscious. We have an opportunity to share what we process in the small interest groups, and then we have an opportunity to hear how our neighbors are processing it too. So all of this takes trust, and trust sometimes depends on consistency. And so my little talk tonight is to tell you how important your presence is at the small interest group. The one that you've chosen is the one that we're hoping you will stay with. Our loyalty in attending the group is important to us on an individual basis to deepen the conference, but also important to us as a cohesive body. So that being said, I will also say that if you feel that you have made a mistake and chosen the wrong interest group for yourself, please come and talk to me or to one of the other planning committee members, and But remember that the slight resistance that you might feel, or the possible unease that you might feel, could be just precious to you in that group. There could be gold in that. So what I'll do now is to introduce the school interest group leaders. And what you'll do is take folks to another spot so that you can talk to each other and just meet, at least. You don't have to go to the room where you're going to be having the group, but I'll tell you where that is, too.